97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show. We have a very exciting show in store for you today because we have Alec Guttle, and he is here. Actually, we are at the Campus Y on UNC's campus right now at the Cube, which is their social entrepreneur think tank, and he is their social entrepreneur in residence. Welcome, Alec.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks.
So, Alec, Carolina, it's not new to you.
No, not new to me. Nope, went here as an undergrad. Favorite part of my life. Loved it. Very happy to be back.
Well, we're glad to have you back. And you started your political science, your journey here?
Yeah, I mean, my career really started here. I was involved. I actually spent my entire undergrad experience here at the Campus Y, pretty much.
Yep.
And I was involved with a bunch of friends in this nonprofit called SEEK, which...
Yep.
You know, in spite of our inept management, turned into this huge thing while I was here. It was incredibly exciting, and it was really my first kind of entrepreneurial experience. Had all the kind of elements of entrepreneurship, limited resources, and late nights and chaos.
Yes, right.
I loved it. So I've been, you know, trying to recreate that basically ever since.
Must have been a good experience then.
Yeah, it was great.
SEEK is the Student Environmental Action Coalition. And so environmentalism, it sounds like, just in kind of reading through your bio, has run a thread. I mean, we've seen a thread of it.
Yeah, it's been, something I'm really motivated by and interested in. And I haven't always done that. I've definitely taken detours into other industries and other, you know, areas. But I started to get into those kinds of issues in high school. I took a year off before college and worked for NRDC in Washington, and then did SEEK when I was undergrad. And then, you know, after I got out of school, worked in policy for a while, and then in the startup world, which has been most of my career, you know, probably half of it has been in sort of clean technologies.
Very exciting. So you left Carolina. You went and got an MBA. You decided that that was going to be a good thing. And then sounds like you blended all of this into social entrepreneurship.
Yeah, something like that.
What is social entrepreneurship?
That's a good question.
Hear it a lot.
Yeah, and it's funny because I didn't know what it was either when I became social entrepreneur in residence. It turned out I was doing it for a living. So it was,
hey, you.
Yeah, so it's been great to discover what it is. You know, I think of it as one of the ways to describe it is as a fourth sector. So if you think traditionally the sectors have been, you could be in business, you could be a nonprofit, you could be in government. Social entrepreneurship is sort of a fourth sector.
It's
like a hybrid.
Okay.
It's like a hybrid of some of the others. And it's basically, you know, I think of it as the gray area between commerce and community.
Okay.
So imagine if you're coming from a for-profit perspective, it's how do I integrate a social mission into what I'm doing so that I'm doing good in the world. If you're coming at it from a nonprofit perspective, it's how do I use sort of free market business principles to amplify the impact I'm having on the issue that I care about to make it more financially sustainable, those sorts of things. So it's ventures, you know, for example, here at the Cube, it's supporting ventures that are trying to integrate a social mission with some commercial techniques and methods.
Viability, so that they can sustain themselves, so they don't become a flash in the pan or like, you know, it was great and now we're gone. Kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's right. And so some of them are for-profit businesses that really have a social mission in the first place. Some of them are sort of coming at it as more from a nonprofit perspective, but how do we use these kinds of tools to do our work better?
Can any business turn themselves into a social entrepreneurial business? Like, could Apple become socially entrepreneurial? Or does it
Theoretically, I think you could. It can be very hard to change a culture. So I think for a lot of established businesses to really think of them as, you know, social venture would be a bit of a stretch. But certainly incorporating some of those, you know, theories into what they do is a good thing. But you have a really, this emerging sector of companies. Sungevity is one of them.
Right.
Some of them are B corporations. I don't know if you're familiar with that designation.
A little bit.
Yeah, and I don't know if some of your listeners will be, but.
Mm-hmm. Are there five principles to B corporations?
You know, I'm not sure.
Like that.
But basically, designating yourself as a B corporation says we're going to take into account the interests of more than just our shareholders, other stakeholders. Maybe it's our employees, maybe it's our community, other issues that we care about. It basically announces to your potential investors and shareholders, we're going to make decisions based on a bunch of different constituencies, and you need to know that about us. And it's a really important distinction, because historically, business has behaved in ways that can be destructive,
right,
often because their only responsibility and accountability is to their shareholders. And being able to broaden that group of constituencies gives business freedom to do good in the world.
Does. And we've had, I think, do you know Ryan Alice? I'm not sure if you were familiar with Ryan. He came out of Carolina, was also a social entrepreneur, started a big internet corporation that did internet newsletters. Mm-hmm. And his B Corporation definitely took into account employees. He had slides in his office. Games, you know, along with benefits and other things like that. But it was a very refreshing approach to the whole business idea. It was like, we can make this fun, we can make it good for everybody, we can make some money, and we can do good in the world. And
right,
they did. They had a whole thing about doing good in Africa as part of their corporate mission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it's, I think we'll see, I hope we'll see a lot more businesses headed in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also see nonprofits who are becoming much more sophisticated about how to use, you know, market principles to become more financially sustainable and to just have better impact.
Yeah, no, that is definitely huge. So, because you don't want to be dependent on people's money all the time. You want to be able to keep going on your own for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so you got into this by accident. Like, you kind of started it and didn't know you were doing it, and then they kind of named it, and they said, okay, you are a social entrepreneur.
I mean, that's a terminology that is relatively new to me. But, yeah, I mean, so my career, you know, I started doing nonprofit work,
right,
went into government for a couple of years, went to business school, and started doing for-profit stuff, and I've done, you know, five different startups, some clean tech, some sort of more traditional.
Okay, so let's talk about your first startup experience. What was it?
Well, if you don't count Seek, which was basically a startup.
Yes, but fair enough.
Yeah, I was involved in two startups when I was in business school.
Okay.
One was a clean tech company called Solo Energy, which was this, it's almost not worth getting into.
Okay.
It was a failure. That's the thing to remember about it.
But I think that's important, because not everything turns out perfect.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, and one of my themes about entrepreneurship is there is a lot of luck involved. In this case, we actually made some stupid decisions, and we deserve to fail, I think. But and had some bad luck as well. But, you know, I was a rookie, and we, you know, and happy to come back to what some of those decisions were. But anyway, it was a great experience in terms of a learning experience. We actually did sort of sell what was left of the company to Enron, which was the perfect capper for quite a tale. But I also... one of my best friends started a company called Nixon that made watches for the surf, skate, snowboard demographic, which has gone on to be a really successful company. And I helped him write that business plan, and I invested in it. And I got a ringside seat to that startup, which was a great experience. And so those are my first two.
So, okay, let's just break this down a little bit. How did your friend, was he part of the skateboarder crew? And
yeah, so he's a fascinating guy. He had been a mechanical engineer undergrad, and he lived up in New England. And when he got out of undergrad, he joined Burton Snowboards when it was like a couple of people. And he was literally planing snowboards in a shop at the very dawn of the snowboard age.
Yes.
And so he had great connections all through that industry and recognized that at the time, there was no brand, sort of identity brand for that demographic.
Okay.
And really, watches were, you know, just a way to give these folks an identity, a badge of that they were real, authentic, you know.
They were part of a tribe or part of a club. It gave them an identity.
That's right.
Great business,
yeah.
So he was looking at a way to bring them all together so that they could, like, identify each other without their boards on. Or, you know, while they were
boarding. I think, there's an element of that. There was an opportunity to build a brand that would have a lot of meaning to a particular demographic, and really does. And he's built it's an incredible business with a great culture that really... you know, really kind of lives the values of that community.
I bet that'd be a fun place to work.
It's really fun. It's in Encinitas, California, right on the beach.
Right.
Every one of them has a surfboard, surfing on their lunch breaks.
Forget the siesta, we're hitting the waves.
Yeah, no, it's good living out there for sure.
All right, so started up with that, or you wrote the business plan for that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that would be overstating things.
Okay.
I was in his study group in business school.
Okay.
Andy wrote the business plan. I tried to edit it here and there.
Involved. You were on the periphery.
I was involved, and I was an investor in the business and helped a little bit with that. But really, I've just been an observer in a really, really great process.
All right, well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about how to turn a business idea into a tangible product. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show, and I am talking with the social entrepreneur in residence at UNC, Alec Guttel. So, Alec, you have done a bunch of startups, and some have gone well and some have been challenging, we'll say. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people out there who have this dream of owning their own business, and you know, it's been with them for a while. They just haven't had the skills or the knowledge or, you know, to make it happen. So let's talk about, how do they turn their ideas into a tangible product? How would you advise them?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a lot of variables there, so it depends on all, a lot of things. You know, I feel like there are two phases. You know, there's sort of the pre-decision phase and the post-decision phase.
Okay.
You know, and the pre-decision phase is a great phase, and a lot of your listeners are probably in that phase.
It feels good. It's fun.
It's fun. It's ideation.
Yeah.
And I think the important focus in that phase is customer feedback. There's a real tendency that people have to, you know, get really involved with their idea and think about it a lot and come up with new elements to it, and how it's going to be so exciting. And it's really important to make sure that those ideas
in their head.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And we've all done that.
Right.
And those ideas need to meet reality as much as humanly possible before you make
an
actual decision. Yeah, because there's, you know, I think that once you make a decision to really start something, things get a lot more serious in a hurry. So you want to make sure
there's money on the line.
There's money on the line.
Yeah.
There's career risk.
Yeah.
There's, you know, balance of life, family issues. I mean, you're making a real bet when you do this kind of thing. And I don't think, I do see people who try to think they've made the decision to start, but they're still doing it on the side of their desk and they're keeping their day job. And for the vast majority of ideas, that's not realistic. It's hard enough that it needs all your energy and more. So what I generally tell people is really enjoy that pre-decision phase and do your homework, really get out there and talk to customers and make sure you get as much evidence as you can imagine getting that this is really going to work. And then there's a decision point. And when you do that, I think you have to be all in.
Okay. That's a lot. Okay. So you're in there, you're in your head, it's all great, you're having fun. You need to go find people who you think would buy your services. Do you do it alone? Do you do it with someone?
I mean, you know, that depends. I've always, you know, I've done five startups every time with a partner.
Okay.
And for me, it's one of the most important parts of the process in terms of my personal satisfaction and enjoying it, and I think effectiveness.
I would think there'd be some accountability there, whereas if you were your own boss, or maybe I'm just talking about myself, there would be, you know, not necessarily the best use of time.
There's accountability there.
Yeah.
There's resilience there.
Yeah.
There's risk there too. I mean,
you
know, you have to be a real grown up about how you manage that relationship. One of the number one causes of failure of a startup early on is in that founding partnership. It turns out you don't have the same, you know,
vision,
idea of who's going to be doing what. You know, it's a complicated relationship, and you need to be a grown up about establishing expectations and making sure everybody's heading in the same direction. If you do all that right, I think it really magnifies the positive elements of the whole experience of being an entrepreneur. I mean, it's all about the roller coaster, and it's really nice to have somebody else there when you suddenly see into the
abyss.
You're
about to scream, right?
Yeah, and think everything's going wrong, and somebody who really understands some meaningless little great thing that happened.
Right.
There are two people in the world who can understand why this is great. So
why we got a phone call. Yes.
Yeah, so I'm a fan, and I think, you know, my advice about that is be ambitious, and when looking for a partner, shoot high. I mean, you want to think of who's the most talented person I've ever met in my life who has no business working with me.
Okay.
And make it your job and be persistent about nailing, you know, about knocking down that person. Because
pick me, yes.
Yeah.
So how do you find these people? Obviously television, you know, but, you know, where do you find them?
Yeah, well, I mean, in my case.
Besides the Cube.
Yeah,
here.
The Cube, exactly, which I hope we'll come back to and talk a little bit more about. But, I mean, for me, it's mostly been people I've just come across and sort of in the back. I mean, I have a file in my head of people who I, you know, if I could ever convince that person to work with me, that would be like a, you know, achieving a life ambition. And you want to start to accumulate that list and work your way down it.
Now, here's a question. Do you have ideas for businesses to do with them, or do you just have an idea of, wow, I just like to work with this person, I don't care what the business is?
I think that can go either way. In my case, I have a total, like, psychological disability around accumulating business ideas.
Okay.
So I've got a big, long depth chart of terrible business ideas that I'd like to try, and hopefully a couple good ones. And so for my most recent business, and we didn't talk about Syngevity, which is the one in the middle,
right,
which is probably, you know, the thing I'm asked most about. We can come back to that. But I have a new business in Brooklyn called Imprint. And, you know, for me, Imprint was about working with this woman, Kate Frusher, who's my co-founder, who's, you know, one of the most spectacular human beings. You know, I just can't believe that she's working with me. And we wanted to work together. So we worked through a bunch of different things that we felt were interesting. And there was one thing in particular that really resonated sort of emotionally for both of us as something we really cared about. And that's how we got started.
So what does Imprint do? So can you tell us?
I can, yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's very early days. It doesn't do anything yet, basically, but what it's meant to do. So Imprint, the sort of mission of Imprint is to use technology to try to enrich our lives and add meaning to our lives. We kind of feel like Facebook and some of these other tools sometimes interfere with real meaning. They're sort of a way to broadcast lots of stuff that isn't that meaningful to lots of people. Imprint is about creating really beautiful multimedia portraits of the people that you really love that you can keep.
Okay.
And it was motivated partly by us being sort of in our middle age and having parents who were getting older and thinking, God, I've got like two pictures of my dad. I'm going to end up with two pictures and a gravestone. And that's crazy. Right. I'm walking around with a movie studio in my pocket.
Right.
How do I get a really rich impression of who this person is and what he sounds like and his laugh and the stories that he tells that I will have forever?
Okay.
So that was the initial instinct. And actually, it's turning out to be a lot broader than that. People are using, our customer feedback is about people using this tool to celebrate birthdays and anniversaries.
Oh, yeah.
Having a whole community or family come together to basically build an imprint of somebody as a gift.
Oh, cool.
It's pretty neat. I'm not doing the best job of like the 30-second version, but it's exciting, I think.
There is a show on for a long time called This Is Your Life, and it was, you know, they would do that. They would go surprise somebody, and then they would, I don't know if you ever saw the show, but, you know, it almost sounds a little bit like
it
that.
It is a little like, and I think that is really, really powerful. And the thing, and you can do that for your husband,
right,
you know, and like, it's a really powerful thing. And once you've done it, you then can have it forever and add to it in this dynamic, and, you know, that's an archive of a human being who is the most important thing in the world to you.
Right. Right. And it gives them, too, a sense that to be able to go back and look over their own lives. And I know people get into funks where they're not feeling like they're moving or, you know, life isn't going the way they want. At least they can go back and look at that. And
say, that's right. Well, I think, I mean, to me, it's about there's sort of this psychic itch about I'm not doing this thing that I care about. And we've all got these piles of photos and it's like it's such a mess. I don't know what to do with it.
Yes.
And I'm not doing this thing that I actually really care about, which is get a really rich imprint of my daughter or my wife or.
Yeah.
So that's what it's about.
I love that. Well, all right. So do we go to imprint.com to learn more?
No.
Or nowhere?
No. It doesn't quite exist. Yeah, we're still.
All right. You heard about it first here on the Art of Potential show.
You really did. Don't go out and start it on your own.
Right. Very good. Okay. So here you are. You've now started. This will be your sixth startup?
Fifth, yeah.
Your fifth startup.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go back to number four, because that seems to be the one that brought you to Carolina and brought you here. Tell us a little bit about that one.
So, what you're talking about is Syngevity, which is a solar energy business. And the mission of that business is to make it easy and cheap for homeowners to go solar, basically, to make it just
anybody can go solar.
Actually not, but but to make it much easier for the people who can, which is most people.
Okay.
Not actually
most
everybody.
People can go.
Yeah, and so that was, and it was very much sort of mission-driven from the founding. I started it with two friends. One was a very old friend of mine who spent most of his career at Greenpeace, and then another friend, Andrew Birch, who's our CEO, who actually came out of BP Solar.
Okay.
But an incredible, incredible strategist and leader and become one of my greatest friends. Anyway, we wanted to make it, you know, we saw that solar energy was going to become more cost effective, and we wanted to help smooth that process and make it easier for customers. So we invented a way to use satellites and aerial imagery to design rooftop solar systems, drove a lot of cost out of the process, made it easier for customers, started leasing the system so you don't have to pay for them up front out of your pocket. You can pay as you go, and a bunch of other innovations, and built a real culture around customer service and just making customers happy. And it's been we call it the solar coaster. Because lots of ups and downs in that industry, but the business is doing great, and I could spend the rest of our time ranting about how transformative solar technology is going to be in the world.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want you to tell us about how to get money to do all these ideas.
Sounds good.
All right, you are listening to the Art of Potential show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemster with The Art of Potential Show, and I am talking with social entrepreneur in residence at The Cube, which is part of UNC's entrepreneurial efforts to bring entrepreneurship to the students. Now, Alec, you have started 5 businesses now. And of those businesses, let's talk about the money side, because I think that's a thing a lot of people struggle with.
Right.
Did you just say, oh, look, I have a pocket full of money, I think I'll start a business? Did you go out and try to get people to come on board with you? How did that all work?
Yeah, I love that idea. Right. I want to start again and do it that way. Right. Got a pocket full of money. Well, you know, it depends very much on the venture and how much money you need and those sorts of things. I mean, my first message on this topic is don't raise money until you need it, which you wouldn't think would be advice people need. But actually, people have a tendency to really get focused on the financing.
Yes.
As an end in itself, and it's sort of a validation. But raising money is not a validation. Making money is a validation.
Fair enough. Raising money is a validation that someone believes in your idea and therefore it will be successful.
It's easy to think about it that way. I don't encourage that.
I understand.
And you know, it can, I like to think of financing as an outcome, not an input. If you develop a great idea, if you can show real customer traction, if you can establish revenues and have revenue growth, then you're going to be able to raise money, the right kind of money for your business, and you can treat money like any other input into your business, like hiring talent or getting a copier. I mean,
so you're in control of it at that point.
Exactly. That's
okay.
You know, in the ideal world, this is how you want to approach things. And so, you know, to the extent that you can bootstrap to prove that kind of business traction, that's the way to go raise money, is to already, you know, is to put the horse before the cart.
Okay.
Put the business before the financing, to the extent that you can. And then when it comes time to raise money, then it just depends on what kind of money you need to raise, what kind of business you're trying to build. I mean, there's a lot of variety. But, you know, it's even in the 20 years I've been doing this, it's really evolved and matured in terms of the infrastructure of different kinds of investor options that are out there. People are much more familiar with angel investing and friends and family, and you know, you can figure out how to raise $30,000 if you need it. You can figure out how to raise $500,000 if you need it. And if you need $3 to $5 million, you can, you know, there's a bunch of VCs out there who like to do that. So you just have to be thoughtful about really what you need at this stage, and then pick the right source for that kind of capital.
Wow. Okay. So this is a very different way of thinking about money, because I think a lot of people do think about the angel investors. Now, are angel investors, do they give seed money? I'm not real sure about all the...
Just the terminology and who does what.
Yeah.
So yeah, an angel investor is, you know, would be distinct from an institutional investor. An institutional investor would be a fund, like a venture capital fund, where you have, you know, people professionally investing that money. An angel investor is just anybody who's writing checks to participate in a startup, basically out of their own account.
So what do they get out of it?
They get ownership in the company. And, and you know, I don't know how detailed you want to get into this. You know, depending on the stage of your company, they'll get a different amount of ownership based on how much money they put in. There's a very common technique called a convertible note, which we can talk about if you like, but that basically delays the process of figuring out how much of the company they should get.
Ooh.
Which is, no, it's a good thing. It's actually a very efficient, it's hard to explain, but a very efficient solution.
Well, I would think if you're starting up and you don't have the money and someone else does, you would want a convertible note so that they don't have full ownership.
Well,
both
parties get a benefit from it.
Okay.
Because basically the price that you're setting for their shares will change based on how much you achieve over the next couple of quarters, for example.
Okay.
And so you're both placing a bet. If you don't achieve as much, then they're going to end up owning more of your company. And if you exceed your goals and do great, then they're going to end up buying less of the company for their money.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's a good system. You don't want to spend the 5 minutes explaining exactly how it works, but you know,
we got the basics.
You got the basics. Yep.
All right. So Alec, I have this friend and he wants to start his own radio station, let's say. How are you going to advise him, or how would you advise him on what he needs to do to get that up and going?
Well, you know, I mean, there are probably 1,000 different pieces that might change based on what the business is and the industry and that sort of thing. I'd say that the things that would be in common with just about any business, you know, number one would be, you need to dedicate the bulk of your time to interacting with whoever your customers are.
So
right
identify
now.
Your customers, figure out who they are, what they want.
Who's paying the bills in your business? And it sounds like it might be advertisers in that business. Who are the specific advertisers you're going after? How much time are you spending with them? What do they really want? What do they have today? What are the strengths and weaknesses? How do they like your idea? How would they tweak it? That's where you need to be spending the bulk of your time, and that's where people often go wrong.
Okay, it sounds though like if it's a radio station, I'm just thinking you're going to want to do your listeners and then find out who they're going to respond to as advertisers.
Both.
Yeah.
I mean, you have two different customer constituencies as a radio station, so you need to be spending time with both. And you can't spend too many hours doing that. So that would be one thing to be common to just about any startup. And the second one for me is just, you know, is talent. Is, you know, what are the other pieces of the puzzle in terms of the team that you need to put together? You know, what are your strengths and weaknesses? What do you need to add to this team? And who are the best people in the world that you can imagine getting to join you? And how are you going to go get them? You know, if you have a really talented team and a really good customer proposition that's tested and proven, then I think, you know, as long as your market timing is good, then you've got a really good shot.
As long as your market. And besides that market timing.
That's the other one. But that's a hard thing to control.
Right.
But from an investor perspective, I tend to think in terms of market timing and team. Those are, you know, I just want to know that you can have real confidence around your customer proposition.
So you're going big. I mean, you're not starting out with some mom and pop shop. You're like, let's get the best possible person we can find who is silly enough to work with us and bring them on board and go big or go home.
A lot of my encouragement with the entrepreneurs I work with on campus is around that, is around being really ambitious about recruiting. Recruiting is the number one most important job of an entrepreneur. And it doesn't get enough time. It doesn't get enough sort of attention, strategic focus. And it's the most important thing that you do is recruit talent to your business and get people to, you know, go tell their spouse that they're going to give up their real job, take a pay cut, and take a flyer on this crazy thing with this maniac. And that's a tough thing to do. And if you can do that right, you're a long way down the road because, you know, if you're in a good market with a great team, you're likely to figure out the rest.
Yeah, the team will all work together. I want to go back again to, and you've already talked about this, but it's really interesting to me. Let's say you've got somebody who has all of these things. They have the idea. They know what their listeners want. They have some ideas about their advertisers. How are they going to identify the talent? They're going to call through the magazines and figure out who's moving and shaking, networking. Mm-hmm. Walk me through that process.
I think it can be that. And often, you know, it depends on where you are in your career and how ambitious your idea is. I mean, whether you're really looking for like major public figures. I mean, often it's, you know, it might be somebody from your personal network of people that you've worked with. I mean, most startups come from people who've been in an industry before and now starting something new.
Yes.
That's been the case for me most of the time is that, you know, I'm trying to recruit people who I've come across in my professional life and just think, you know, wow. Yeah.
I'd be so lucky to work with them.
Yep.
Got it. Okay, very good. All right, so then this person, let's say they go out, do all that. Your advice then to them would be bootstrap, show that you can get the advertisers, show that you've got listeners, and then hit up your investors for money.
The best scenario about raising money is basically what you described. Ideally, you can have a controlled, managed, focused pilot of this idea in this business, and you can show that it works.
Right.
Yeah, because what an investor wants to hear is,
we're already making money.
I've got this all locked. I've got a great team. My customers love it. It's growing. Now I just need money to scale it. That's what investors want to hear. And you get more money at a better price if that's the story you're telling. To the extent that you can bootstrap or just, you know, keep your sort of finances to a financial outlay to a minimum and get those proof points, that's kind of the ideal way to do it.
Then do you give the investors your business plan, your cost benefit analysis, like, you know, how do you do that?
Well, it depends a lot on where you are and how much money you're raising and what industry, you know, there's a lot of those kinds of things.
Absolutely.
But, you're going to make a pitch that people aren't really using text business plans anymore. When I got into this, people were writing, you know, 40 page things, big, long pro forma financial statements and all this stuff. It's a lot more PowerPoint these days.
Okay.
And it's a lot more evidence-based these days, ideally. So it's like, this is kind of the proof points we have, the customers we've spoken to, what the reaction has been. A little less sort of theoretical and texty and a little more sort of real-world
interesting
summary.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to hear more about what's happening on UNC's campus, what the Cube is about, and all the excitement over here. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show, and I am talking with social entrepreneur in residence, Alec Guttle. Now, Alec, you are in residence here at UNC's The Cube. Can you tell me about The Cube?
Sure, yeah. I'm very excited about it. So The Cube is an incubator for social ventures on the campus at UNC, housed at the Campus Y. And it's a home for social entrepreneurs from all over the campus, undergrads, grad students, faculty, staff, even some alumni. And The Cube basically picks some of the most exciting social ventures from across the entire university and gives them a bunch of resources and a place to work and mentorship, a little bit of funding, and all kinds of other, a whole sort of ecosystem of support services to help them get off the ground. And it's a really, it's just a really exciting sort of groundbreaking thing.
That is amazing.
It is amazing. It's outside the classroom, experiential learning for the students. It's free for the students, and it's a model that I think is going to be, replicated on a lot of campuses. They just had an event in New York, and like Bobby Kennedy was talking about this, the Cube at UNC, and how it's a great model. So it's pretty exciting.
It's catching on.
Yeah. It's catching on over here. Yeah, I'm really happy to be a part of it.
So does the Cube then, do people come with lots of ideas and then they get called down? Can anybody come in with an idea? Like, how does that work?
Just about, yeah. I mean, anybody from across the university community, and there is a process where people say, this is my idea, and they pitch it and they go through a whole sort of filtering process, and 10 ventures are selected for support for the next program.
So when people get support, they get Ted Zoller, they get you, how does the support work?
Yep, they get mentors, and they also get a real network of other kinds of support, legal and administrative and,
great.
Yeah,
okay.
All kinds of stuff. Business planning, connections with other parts of the university, connections off campus, I make a lot of introductions for these ventures with people who have nothing to do with the campus, because a lot of these are, they're not all undergrads, many of them are. They don't really have a network of their own yet, and helping them connect with
sides in their dorm room.
Exactly.
And that will mean something one day.
It will, but not yet. So, those kinds of connections that really help them take a really good idea and make it more sophisticated, get the feedback they need, get the support they need, and make it real.
So what's been your favorite part of doing this?
I mean, this is a bit of a cliche, but like sitting down with these groups and just really talking about what it is they want to achieve and, helping them think it through. I mean, it's a great thing to watch. It's amazing. I think I worry about entrepreneurship sometimes because it's such a cultural moment for entrepreneurship, and we're promoting it so much. But one thing I love about it is incredible learning framework. And this, it just integrates so many things. And we get such talented kids in here with, really exciting ideas, and watching them sort of apply this sort of entrepreneurship framework is just, it's really satisfying.
Very satisfying. And the energy that comes from people who are thinking that way and just being on a campus and younger people, they just have a very fresh energy about them. It's fun to work with. They haven't been beaten down.
Down. And it's our job to beat them.
Right. But there's something fun about that. They'll say things that other people think or whatnot. I totally enjoy that about working with this age. So friends come together, they're in their dorm room, they're like, oh dude, we should totally make watches that skateboarders will buy or whatever it is. And then
Here at the Cube, they're all social ventures, so they tend to have a social mission. And I found this broadly beyond the Cube too, is that more than when you and I were here,
right,
when kids define what they want out of life, it's I want to be happy and I want to do good, and mm-hmm. which is not to say we weren't saying that. I think they mean it. That's
right.
and so a lot of these things, and then it's not always just like a couple undergrads in a dorm. One of the things we're seeing is that people are already coming in with an interesting array of, there's a couple undergrads, two grad students, and a faculty advisor out of the School of Public Health or whatever. And that's a really powerful combination, the sort of energy and sort of and mission and of some of the younger guys with the connections and stuff from other parts of the campus.
That is, and I want to go back to what you're saying, the way they're coming in a group with a very positive outlook on business, and this may have just been me, but if I recall back in the 80s, businesses were kind of, they weren't looked at favorably necessarily. They were kind of not about the public good. They were something that were out there. You know, we were fighting them because they were dumping sludge or, doing whatever. So it's a different concept of business. Now seeing business is a very positive thing, well, which it is.
Yeah, like, exactly.
I mean, everybody needs to be employed.
Well, and, you know, and it's, even if you're not motivated commercially, you're motivated by a social mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are tools that are incredibly, incredibly powerful.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, with Sungevity, you know, there was a policy phase where Danny was, my partner, was really focused on getting the policy framework in place to support solar. But after a while, it was like, well, we need to drive costs down and get bring this to the market and have it scale, because the market can scale things way faster than you're going to get there with government. And that's been, you know, that's been really effective. I mean, you know, the market works. That's why it dominates the world. And, yeah, and if you want to achieve a social mission, often those are some really, you know, useful tools to have. So,
what are some of your favorite ideas that you've seen come through here?
There's a, right after we're done, I'm going to be meeting with a sophomore who has an idea. It's a business called Freedom Code. He's from Colorado, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He went to India with a church group, got hooked up with some nonprofits there that were supporting development in some, you know, challenged communities. And he had the idea of putting QR codes on these products that they were making.
Ooh.
They were being sold back here in the U.S., basically to raise money and foster economic development. And the QR code on the scarf lets you see the person who actually made the scarf and tell you a little about the organization that supports her. And what he found was that that really accelerated the sales of those products and also created some engagement between the buyer over here in the U.S. and the organization and the challenge over in, you know, in India. Really powerful tool. And he created the technology. All this, he's a sophomore. The kid's amazing.
Yeah.
And so now the next step is, how do we take this really powerful methodology and allow other profits who are doing similar importation of goods for economic development to benefit from the same idea? I hope he doesn't mind me telling the whole world about that. But it's a great idea. He's an amazing. His name's Cole Johnson. He's, you know, he's incredible. And this is one of, you know, there are 9 other organizations doing similar, really innovative things here. So it's a great place to be.
So do you often find yourself going through your own personal Rolodex? Like, how can I help him, and who do I know that would help him, and things like that? Is that just a natural thing that happens?
Yes, very much. That's a big part of what I do. Although, you know, at the right moment. I mean, sometimes, you know, they're all different stages. Some of them are pretty, they're already out there in the market doing something. Some are sort of idea stage, and there's somewhere in between is when it's most helpful to make those kinds of connections. But that's a big part of what I do, and the other sort of support network at the Cube.
All right. So in closing, what kind of advice would you have given to your younger self?
That's a great question. you know, I would like to have been better prepared for the resilience that's required, I think, to be an entrepreneur. Of course, you know, it's ups and downs and everything, and you know that in the abstract, but the experience of it is actually pretty intense. And
being in the belly of the whale,
I think that would be good.
Yeah.
For me personally, my biggest sort of challenge is focus. Like, I'm sort of, I love ideas, and you can easily kill a business or any other kind of startup by just having kind of mission creep and saying, oh, this is a good idea, but this is also a good idea, and we're going to do both, and see, they both work together, and you can tell yourself the story about how you need to be doing more than one thing, and one thing is plenty hard enough. And so narrowing it down, focusing, getting one thing right, that would have been good advice for me to give myself back then. Not now, other people have different weaknesses. That's really an Achilles heel for me, so that would have been one.
What keeps you up at night?
Well, it's definitely, you know, it's the people that it's you know, both in terms of your partners and the people that you draw into this thing that you want to go do, and putting all that at risk, the employees who, as we talked about before, you know, took a risk, took a pay cut, took a flyer, you know, that's hard to carry around. And you worry about that. And then the other side of it is, you know, like a lot of careers, there's some real balance, sort of life, family, work balance issues that come up as an entrepreneur, and those things keep you up at night as well. But those are also the things that make it great, I think.
I was going to say, what gets you out of bed in the morning?
And it's the people. It's the people that I work with. It's, you know, I love being attached to a mission that I really care about, and it makes me feel like, I'm, you know, I mean, you know, we're all motivated by the people that we love and wanting them to be proud of us. And so the same things that keep me up at night are the things that get me out of bed in the morning.
Fantastic. Well, Alec, thank you so much for joining us. You have been a wonderful guest.
Thank you.
So if you'd like to learn more about the Cube, go to cubeunc.org, and they have fantastic videos and all kinds of information about how you may be able to get involved. You have just listened to the Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra. Please take a moment to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.